Well, John Mackey, welcome here to WUFT Classic. I'm glad to have you here. So I think that you and I are kind of maybe of a similar generation, a generation in which technology has been a part of our lives,
yes. Right?
Our whole lives. And this can be a wonderful creative force. Can you talk a bit about how technology has maybe helped shape your composing career?
Well, that's an interesting question, especially, I mean, in my case, I'm kind of unusual in that I, you know, I'm a full-time composer, but I never studied an instrument formally. So I started writing when I was 11, I think, 10 or 11, using music software. My grandfather had a music program in the early 80s and showed me how to write music using this music software called Music Instruction Set. And all you did with that was, you know, you drag rhythmic values up to from the bottom of the screen up to a, you know, piano staff at the top, and then push the fire button on the joystick on a little piano icon. It would play your music for you. And so I just started throwing notes onto a piano staff and then playing it back and hearing what I liked. And so, you know, I did eventually, you know, I can obviously read music, and I can, if you put me in front of a piano, I know what all the notes are, but I don't have the training to really play a piano. So everything is done still with me with software. I've just gotten much, much nicer software since the early 80s. But everything is done with, you know, MIDI, which is the way the computer can control, you know, playback of synthesizers and things like that. I use sample libraries. And so everything is done that way. And has been since I was a little kid. So and without technology, I don't think I wouldn't be a composer. And I think if I were any older, I don't know that I would be a composer, because if I were any older, the software that you could use it at home would not have existed when I was 10 years old, if I was much older at all.
And in the process of learning to write and finding your voice, you also ended up studying with some great teachers. And in that process, did you kind of have to learn, or did you teach yourself what every instrument is capable of? Because you're writing for instruments that, and any composer will do this, whether it's, you know, Bach or whether it's a Messiaen, they're going to write for instruments that they don't play.
Sure. You know, so I, you know, one, I don't know if it's a benefit or not, but because I never formally studied any instrument, I, good or bad, don't really know what the biggest challenges are on any instrument. So that means I don't, you know, this sounds, I don't know if this is a good thing. I don't concern myself too much with how difficult something is to play. Now, if I'm writing something for like a middle school band, which I do also, I have to, because they just don't know all the buttons yet necessarily. Yeah. So that's a case where I have to, you know, over time I've gotten better about learning, you know, what the limitations are, the challenges of various instruments. But because I never was a music ed major, I never took an instrument methods class. So I never tried to make a sound on a bassoon. So I don't know how hard that is. I just know it's hard in my experience of hearing young bassoon players. It sounds very hard.
Yes.
You know, I learned to write for all the instruments just by listening to a lot of music and following scores while I would listen to things. You know, I think I learned the most about orchestration and what every instrument could do, really from studying Ravel for the most part. I mean, really a lot from like Daphnis and Chloe. In my work study job in undergrad, I worked in the music library, and I would go to the stacks and get a score, and then I would get a CD and I would just listen to that piece and follow the score while I was just sitting there at the CD station to check out CDs to students who would come in. And, you know, I'd be like, oh, I'm going to listen to Daphnis and Chloe, and I'm only going to follow the flutes and just see what he does with the various flutes. You know, he's got piccolo and alto flute and regular C flute, and like how he dovetails between them to make one line sound like one huge flute and things like that. And now I'm going to listen through and just listen to double reeds. And so that was really important for me, learning about like how instruments sound in various ranges, at least as, you know, approached by someone who is, I think, the greatest orchestrator there's ever been.
Uh-huh. I think that many people would agree with you. I think it's fascinating you picked Daphnis and Chloe, a work that is extremely challenging for any orchestra, really. But it has everything that an instrument can do. It's going to be doing it there.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And yeah, I guess I have not really thought about the fact that, yeah, that piece is really hard. Yeah. So I don't know if that's the best, you know, reference for like, this is what the instruments all do, which could be why a lot of my music is very difficult. But it is a great way to learn without physically playing the instruments is to, you know, listen to a lot of music while looking on the staff of like what each instrument is doing. And, you know, my mother played in community orchestras and she was a single mother and couldn't afford babysitters. And so I was with her at every single orchestra rehearsal that she played, like every Sunday for 3 hours. So I would go sit in the high school auditorium where the community orchestra rehearsed and I would hear every piece, you know, they would rehearse for 3 hours or whatever. And so not having a score, I was much younger at that point. I was, you know, 6 years old through, you know, my early teens, but still just hearing live music every week, because I had no choice, was, I think, very formative in like learning what the instrument sounded like.
Well, you anticipated one of my questions earlier, and writing for collegiate or professional ensembles, you're certainly capable of expressing yourself almost as freely as you might want to. But you're also writing for ensembles who, it's going to be younger musicians who are, you know, going to find very challenging music, very challenging to play. Now, I'm guessing that you didn't play in any sort of like musical ensemble when you were young, but you've no doubt heard any number of young music ensembles. Now, do you find when you're writing music for them that it's tricky to kind of like stay in the mind of a young player who, you know, and figuring out what they're capable of doing?
Yeah, I think it's by far for me harder to write easier music. I feel like it's kind of like there are a certain number of difficulty points that go into any piece, and either the players have to be able to do it or I have to be able to do it. So if the players can't play things that are technically too advanced, then that means the music has to be, every note has to be just perfect. Knowing that it may not be played perfectly, but that it's much more spare. I can't hide behind like crazy percussion fills and flute runs and things like that because they can't technically do it. So it needs to be music that stripped down doesn't, it needs to also not sound stripped down. Like the essential thing is that it has to be a piece that happens to sound easy or happens to be a bit easier to play. And you don't want it to sound easy necessarily. It still needs to make them feel like they're playing something cool and fun and want to stay in band or whatever. So that's a challenge as well, like make something fun for them to play, but also fun for me to listen to because I end up hearing these pieces a lot. And so the real challenge there is just like to make it sound like, not like I wrote an easy piece, but I wrote a piece and they happen to be able to play it even though they don't have a lot of technique yet.
I think that for many people in the listening audience, the life of a composer can seem mysterious, and I think that if you can help kind of break this down, I'm guessing that you get commissions.
Yep.
You probably have commissions going out a ways.
Yep.
You obviously need to deliver on those commissions, so there is the element of, you know, timelines and deadlines and all that, and you need to, you know, focus, you need to have the inspiration for those pieces. But then you write them and they're sort of out in the world and you get that satisfaction. So your life is probably a lot of writing and then it's probably also a lot of traveling because you're probably sometimes going out where these pieces are played. You're here in Gainesville, Florida because the University of Florida is performing a piece of yours. And talk about the kind of balance between the creative part and the writing and then the traveling and kind of like ushering your works into the world.
That's interesting. Very few people ask that kind of a question. It's so different, obviously. Like writing a piece is completely solitary. And I don't love that. You know, it's just me in front of the computer for weeks, then months. You know, I tend to write about 5 minutes of music per month on like a good month. That's about the maximum speed I can do. Even if it's slow music, it still takes about a month to write 5 minutes that I think is usable. And so there's so much time just spent hyper-focused on something that has nothing to do with social interactions at all. And then I get on a plane and I go to a university or, you know, whatever the ensemble is, and have to be super like on in front of people now and be able to like coherently talk about the piece. And especially the first time I hear a piece live, when it's a new piece, is I'm useless because my MIDI, like the mockups that I do on the computer while I'm writing them, I work very, very hard on those, probably harder than I need to make them sound really good. And I think they're quite convincing, but it's still not the same as real people. So then I get in a room with real people and my brain just goes into this, like it's overload of this stimulation of like, oh, that's what that sounds like. And, oh, that I should have put a different articulation there. Oh, I didn't, like, is that not working because they can't play it? Is that not working because I didn't notate it right or I scored it wrong? Like what, who made the mistake? Like it's, and then they want comments and I'm just like, I don't know. I don't know what I just heard because I'm happy to hear it, but it's just such an overwhelming thing. By the second time I work with a group, then I can rehearse a piece, you know, then I've like figured out, I've forgotten, I can block out what it sounded like on the computer and now work to like, how do I shape it with real people? But that's still challenging the first group because the first group, they may have limitations that I'm not sure yet if that's the piece or them. If a second or then a third group is struggling with the same material, like the balance is still not right, I still have to give comments to fix things that I know that was me. Like, then it means like I marked that dynamic wrong. Every time I have to ask them, no, I want more crescendo there. That means I didn't make it clear in the music how much crescendo I wanted or whatever. And so I love the travel. I mean, I don't love getting anywhere. That's not fun. But once I'm there, it like working with an ensemble is like my favorite part. The concerts are not my favorite part, interestingly, because in rehearsals, it's just like, let's all work together and make this as good as we can make it. And this is going to be a great time. And then in the concert, it's completely out of my hands. The audience doesn't know the piece at all. So whatever they hear, they think I did. And so even if there's a mistake, they think I probably wrote it that way. And then I get up and bow and I want to be like, no, that wasn't how it's supposed to go. But like, you know, I'm powerless. And so performances are kind of, when they're fun, they're the most fun thing in the world. But when they're not, you know, like it's, you know, I have to just, you know, be a cheerleader and, you know, be happy with every, you know, how it appear to be happy. But a scary performance is scary for a composer.
Yeah, right. And there has to be a good deal of trust between you and those who are performing your works. Let's talk a little bit about what happens when you release a piece kind of into the wild and how much interpretive freedom do you as a composer like to give to those who are performing your music? And at a certain point, it's just going to be out of your hands.
Sure. That is a great question. And it's, I think I am willing to give up more control as the piece gets older. The newer the piece is, the less I want to turn that over. And the more I want to hear it the way I imagined it to know whether or not that worked. And then once I've heard a performance like that, then I'm much less like super controlling. Like my earliest piece, my first band piece I wrote in 2004, I think. And it's now been played many hundreds of times. And I've worked with 75 groups or something on it. And, you know, for the first year or so, I wanted it to sound a certain way. Now, that is the type I mentioned, like how stressed I am in performance. I am so unstressed in performances of this piece called Red Line Tango. And it is, there is no wrong answer at this point. I've heard it so many ways. And now it's fun. It's fun to hear the interpretation that the conductor brings and the soloists and things. And you mentioned the word trust, which is a great thing because when a conductor brings me in, they don't have to do that. I mean, they're contractually obligated for the premiere because that's part of the contract, is I have to be there the first time it's played. But after that, no one has to bring me in. The conductor could just like be like, this is how I want this to go, and this is how we're going to do it. And what's amazing is the conductors who will say, you know, I know how I want this to go, and I'm going to bring in the composer anyway, and, you know, trust that we will work together and come up with like a collaborative agreement of how, you know. But, you know, conductors generally will defer to the composer if the composer is there. So that to me is like a surprisingly selfless decision for a conductor to make, to bring in a composer who can second guess them in front of their own ensemble after they've been rehearsing the piece for some amount of time.
Yeah.
I once worked with a legendary band conductor named H. Robert Reynolds, who was at University of Michigan forever and taught everybody. And I worked with him years and years ago on a piece called Hymn to a Blue Hour. And it's a very slow piece. And he was doing the piece, it was at Tanglewood, and it was an early rehearsal, and it was very slow. Like, it was just way too slow. And he finished it, and he like turns to me in the audience, like, you know, come on up and, you know, make some comments. And I said, I feel like it's very slow. And he said, I know. And I said, but I feel like maybe it's a little bit too slow. And he said, I don't think it is. And I said, but it's called Hymn to a Blue Hour. Like, it's supposed to sound like a church hymn, like something you could sing this melody and it would have text and you would understand the text because you wouldn't have forgotten the first word of the text by the time we get to the end of the line. And he turns to the ensemble, which is all high school students at Tanglewood. And he says, you know, John and I have been working together for many years. You know, what you are seeing is an act of collaboration between a composer and a conductor. And what John seems to have not figured out yet is when he leaves, I'm going to do it the way I'm going to do it. And I was like, huh. And, you know, everybody laughed. And then I came back a couple days for the concert, and it was his original tempo. It was still really, really slow. The difference was they had rehearsed it several more days. The players knew that it was going to be that tempo. And so the lines that were happening, they learned how to shape them really beautifully by the time of the concert. And when I heard it, it just felt like they could barely play the lines that long. Like an oboe line, I'm like, this doesn't, it's just, I'm so bored. It wasn't boring by the time I heard the concert a few days later. So I begrudgingly admit that his tempo was, in fact,
you come around on it.
Yes, but it has to be done the way he does it. Like, it doesn't mean that that's the new tempo of the piece. It means that if you're going to do it at that tempo, you are introducing more challenges for the players that you have to be able to get that out of them to play it at that speed so that it sounds like it has flow and shape rather than just it's too slow. So,
oh, that's fascinating. So if you were to hear a different ensemble and they played it at the tempo in which you originally conceived it, mm-hmm. is there any interpretation that you would prefer or even believe is the way that the piece really should go now?
It's interesting. I still think that piece should be faster than conductors want it to be. I think it has a lot of really lush harmony in it, and I think conductors, if they get it in tune, they feel like, let's just sit on this beautiful harmony a little bit longer before we give the resolution or whatever. And I think there is room for that. But at some point, I also, maybe because I know the piece so well and I've heard it so many times, I do get bored with that piece and all of my pieces. You know, like if I feel like it's going on too long, I know what's coming. So, you know, I'm no longer surprised by nothing in the music. Maybe in the interpretation, I'll be surprised. But that means if you're going to do something really slow, you need to surprise me with the interpretation so I don't feel like this piece is just boring to me personally.
Composer, I think you're familiar with, John Corigliano.
That was my teacher, yeah.
I remember he came here once, and I had a recording of one of his works, Rage and Remembrance. And, you know, I was a fan, so I asked for an autograph, as one does. And he said to me as he held up the recording, I won't tell you which recording, I won't tell the audience which recording I had. And he says, this isn't the recording that I prefer. There was another famous conductor who had another recording that he said he liked better.
Yeah.
And
I know which two recordings you're talking about, and I know which one he likes better, but I won't say either.
Yes. So. And so this is like any sort of creative endeavor that isn't just, you know, I guess if you're a novelist and you write a novel, that just kind of stands there alone. But if you're a playwright and you write a play, you've got to be okay with people doing stuff.
Yeah. Recordings are tough for me. I think it's very important if the composer is alive that the composer be at the recording session.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that I have attended of my own music, I think are far better recordings, and I think people will agree. I think people will hear those performances on recording and think, wow, that's more interesting or has more something happening. Because I'll say things about like, no, the tempo has to be exactly this here. It's really important that like this piece be at this specific speed to really like have sparkle the way it needs to or whatever. Or like, it's really important that you push. I know I didn't make it super clear, but this crescendo has to be super exaggerated here so that it's really exciting when we get to this arrival point or whatever. So I think those recordings are far better. And I have had the same situation that you described with John Corleano, where I have a lot of recordings out, and there's one that is by far the most popular. Like a major university did it, and it's a lot of my music, two albums worth of my music as a double CD set, and I wasn't there for any of those sessions. And as a result, they're not very good. I mean, there are much better recordings of all of them, but that is a very popular ensemble that people know for its recordings. And so people get that and have asked me to sign it. And I'll be like, you should really get the University of Texas recording of anything you can find. Or, you know, people will put up reference recordings when they're rehearsing a piece, and I'll see what they're choosing. I'm like, why did you choose that one rather than the one that's on my website? If it's on my website, that is my favorite recording that exists. Like, that is, you just know if it's on the website, that's what I want it to sound like of what I have heard on recordings. But it's tough. I mean, you can't say, no, don't record it. You want to have your music captured, but it's, you know, there are some recordings that, there's a recording that's very damaging, actually, of the piece that's happening this week here at University of Florida, a piece called The Frozen Cathedral. And it has to be a specific tempo. It's marked like quarter note 100. And there's a recording out there that they do it at quarter note 82, which makes it a dirge. Mm. And 100 is a weird tempo because it's kind of not really fast, not really slow. 82 starts to make it slow. And so it just sounds like the brass players can't play the notes that long, like they're running out of breath, like they can't build the big chorale because they can't play it that slow. The sparkly part doesn't dance anymore. It just kind of sounds like a downer. But because that recording is so popular, there have been a lot of times I've shown up on a campus and they're doing it at 82, even though the score says 100, because they're like, oh, those recordings are very respected. So he must have had something to do with that and given his a stamp of approval of that tempo, even though that's not what the score says. And so your recordings can be problematic for a composer if they're not, you know, like signed, like officially, like, you know,
yeah,
I like this one. So.
You mentioned your website. What is your website so listeners can find you?
Just johnmackey.com. Eventually, I got johnmackey.com. It used to be something else, but through much negotiation, I finally got my own name as my domain name. And people were like, oh, did they register johnmackey.com because of you? No. There are two much more famous John Mackeys. One founded the Whole Foods supermarket chain, but I think they registered that name because he's an NFL Hall of Fame tight end from like the 70s, I think, like considered like there's an award named after him, the John Mackey Award, which is for like best college tight end. So someone at some point registered every NFL football player's name, and I was that was a problem for me, it turned out.
I wonder if you've ever gone to a performance of your work and people show up thinking, man, this John Mackey is incredibly versatile.
He doesn't even seem like a billionaire who founded the Whole Foods supermarket chain. He's so down to earth. He's like us.
So the piece that you're here to see performed in Gainesville, what is it?
Yeah, it's called The Frozen Cathedral. It's, I don't remember what year I wrote. It's an older piece, you know, 10 years, 11 years, something like that. And it was an interesting commission because it came from the director of bands at the time at University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and they were hosting this big convention, the College Band Director National Association Convention, CBDNA. Happens every other year. It's a national convention, and only 8 universities play at this thing, so it's a big deal to play. All of the college band directors, who are the conductors who do my music, they all go to this conference every other year. And they were UNCG. Was hosting the conference the next year. And the conductor said, I would love for you to write the closer for our concert. And I was like, oh, this is a huge honor. This is great. Absolutely. I would love to. He said, now it's got to be like the greatest closer ever written. It's got to like end and people are like throwing babies and stuff. Yeah. And I was like, okay, that's fine. And he said, like, I want to use like extra players because we're the host ensemble. So we don't have to put extra players on a plane or whatever. It's free for us to have extra players. So like use extra musicians that, you know, will just so they, more people can play. And I said, okay, great. And he said, so, you know, like, I'm like, you know, 15 minutes, greatest closer ever written, super exciting ending. And I need you to write it in honor of my son who died of a drug overdose. And I was like, what? Wow. Like, how is that possible? How do you make a piece that is about the greatest loss anyone can imagine, like the death of their own child, and you, at the end, the audience wants to like stand up and cheer? And I was like, I can't write that piece. And he said, it would mean a lot if you would write this piece. And I think you would do a good job on this piece. And I don't know. So I talked to my wife, Abby, who titles all of my pieces. And we talked about it. We asked the conductor some things about his son, and found out that he loved spending summers at Denali in Alaska, the mountains in Alaska. And he would, you know, fish and hike and things and do mountain climbing. And that seemed to be like one of the few times that he felt really like at peace and safe. And so Abby said, why don't you write a piece that imagines the mountains of Alaska, the grandness of them? You know, you think about mountains and they're, you know, it's rock and ice and snow, and it seems really unappealing, but there's something incredibly like majestic about them, and climbing them feels like an incredible accomplishment, and being around them can feel really, you know, peaceful for people. And she said, why don't you write a piece imagining that mountain as like his sanctuary? So like not like a religious church, but just a place where he felt, this is my safe place. And you could call it the Frozen Cathedral. And I was like, oh my God, that's a great title. And so then I agreed to do the piece. And the idea with the piece, it's in two parts that go straight into each other. The first one is grief. It starts actually with a bass flute solo, which was an interesting challenge to write for probably the quietest instrument that exists in band and make it audible while other people are playing. So the piece is incredibly quiet at the beginning. And then by the end, it's the loudest thing that ever happened. Like it ends with a plagal cadence, like the amen cadence, but so loud. And by the end, I've surrounded the audience with those extra players that he asked for. Like they're a bunch of percussionists in the audience playing triangles and glockenspiels and just metallic, pretty sparkly things. And the ending is like a very like majestic, healing kind of an ending. I think it's one of my best pieces. And it's, I think generally the best pieces are the ones I don't want to write, because I'm afraid of writing them. And then my wife says, but that's the reason you should write it, because this is not an easy, like, phone it in piece. This is like something that will, you'll write an actual from your soul kind of a piece, not just like a bouncy march. But when I finished it, all I wanted to do was write marches.
So then the next time that you get a commission with a challenging prompt, will you think to yourself, that's impossible, I'm not going to do this? Or will you think, it's maybe impossible, but it also could yield really excellent results?
So I did another one a few years after the Frozen Cathedral. My mother had dementia, and she had been a musician, as I mentioned earlier. And I was, you know, I went to see her. She could barely communicate anymore. You know, she recognized me, but called me the name of the cat, you know, like, because in her mind, that is the name of something that she loves. So like she, you know, that made sense to her. And we were in the car, and Scheherazade, Rimsky-Korsakov, came on the radio. And I'm like, oh, you know this piece, you played this piece. And she said, you know, yes, I did. And she started singing along with the flute part. You know, she could barely make a coherent sentence, but she could sing along with the entire flute part for Scheherazade. It was amazing. And I talked about this story on Facebook, actually, and I got basically that this is why music matters. This is why, you know, if you study music, why it's important. And a conductor friend of mine named Gary Hill at Arizona State sent me a message and said, would you write a piece about that, about your mother? And I was like, no, like, who wants to hear a piece about somebody who has dementia? Like, no one wants to hear a piece that gets more and more confused as it goes on and gets darker and darker. And I talked to Abby, my wife, again, and she said, well, here's what we'll do. Because I thought I might, if I did it, I wanted to have text. And she said she would write the text. I could use the text as sort of, and the structure, if I plan the structure really clearly, I could use the structure as emotional armor that would allow me to write the piece. So whenever I felt like I can't do this, at least be like, well, I've already planned the structure. I'm just going to do this transition here. I know what this is. And I would write it that way. Then she wrote the text. The text was memories my mother wished she could still share with me. So I was not prepared for her to like go that personal on the text. And then again, I was like, well, I can't do this. These are real things that happened. And she said, it has to be real things or you're going to write some generic, I love you, I miss you, I can't remember you, you know, just no one cares. A piece that's real, you will write a real piece and it'll be terrifying and you'll write a great piece if you do that. And it was the hardest thing I ever wrote. It was excruciating to write. I literally started therapy, which I probably should have before. I started therapy after I finished that piece. And the way I ended up doing it is the piece takes place backwards. So the piece starts with her at maximum confusion. And as the piece goes on, she becomes more coherent and the text becomes more coherent as it advances. So it ends and it has some resolution because it ends in theory at the beginning of her story when she still remembered everything.
Do you think that that structure also helps because, well, for an audience, it's going to be more satisfying to hear something that doesn't just end in...
Yes. In fact, this idea came from a composer friend of mine who also studied with Corleone, a guy named Adam Schoenberg, and Adam's brilliant. And he and I had breakfast and talked about, should I do this piece? And he said, write it backwards because... Yeah, no one wants to hear a piece that gets more confused, but a piece that becomes clearer and clearer as it goes on, that's a piece that the audience can understand. And also that will be okay to write because you don't want to write a piece that gets darker and darker. It did mean actually that I wrote it backwards, not literally backwards, but I wrote the last third, then the middle third, and then I wrote the beginning last because that was the hardest to write because that was reckoning with like the reality of that moment when I was writing it.
So... everything that you write, whether it's a commission for a band at a school or whether it is one of these pieces that is going to, you know, is going to be extremely personal, they have a part of you. They're made by you, and so they're meaningful to you. But do you feel like the best art that you create is the very deeply personal?
Yes, absolutely. I wish those were not so hard to write. And I don't do that many pieces that are that personal. I think I have, you know, three pieces maybe that are just so, you know, even if it's not known by the audience what a specific thing is, what I'm thinking about when I wrote it, I think people would say, oh, that's one of your better pieces. And I think there's just something about letting yourself be emotionally vulnerable when writing, which I couldn't do. You know, I'm 50 now. I couldn't do that when I was, you know, in my early 30s when I was starting to write for a band because I just didn't have, I didn't feel safe yet. And so that's a thing that comes, I think, just with the maturity of like, yeah, I've been very fortunate that the music that I write has been well received in the medium. And so it felt like, well, I can take a chance and I won't no longer have a career. Like people will still, you know, respect at least the earlier pieces and know that I have written good stuff. Even if this piece where I go out on a limb and try something really personal and sounds different, even if that's not to their liking, they'll be like, well, at least, you know, he was doing something different. And so we still like him and his music. But I needed to build that kind of security for myself in my head, at least, where I felt like I wasn't going to, you know, kill my career by writing a piece that was really personal and then a failure. I will say those performances are, I talked about performances that are not fun. Those performances are by far the least fun. The one, because like, if you don't, I have a piece that's very, you know, light and fun and just the loudest thing ever. And just me trying to write progressive rock, progressive metal for concert band. It's called Asphalt Cocktail. And if you hate Asphalt Cocktail, well, I think you're wrong, but that's fine. I'm not hurt. But if you hate like the piece I wrote about my mother, yeah, then it's like you hate my soul. Yeah. So those are where it gets really, you know, like those are scary. So
you mentioned that, of course, the actual act of composing is a solitary activity. You go out where your pieces are being performed and you work with the ensembles and the folks who are going to be performing your work. You know as well as anybody that, you know, for musicians, whether, you know, it is in the popular music or whether it's in classical music, there is a rush that one gets in performing live in front of people. And there's a good deal of satisfaction in having the audience appreciate it. And the composing is solitary, but how do you feel when you're there and you hear the audience responding favorably to your music?
Yeah, I mean, so I talk about, like, performances aren't fun for me sometimes, unless they're really good. And then there is no bigger high than that, to have a performance that I feel like, wow, that was as good as that can sound. And then I get to bow, and then the crowd goes nuts, and I'm like, I did that thing. That makes it so worth, like, that I spent 6 months, you know, feeling like this is the worst thing I've ever written. Everyone's going to hate this. And then there's just this relief, like, oh, okay, that went great. You know, nothing feels like that. And that can be, in a way, you know, this would be a whole other conversation, but it's a way, it's a little bit addictive. But what you can't do is, like, go chasing that. You can't write pieces to try to get that reaction. Because if I do that, I don't write a very good piece. The audience can tell. Like, I think they know how authentic something is, whether it's like a sad piece or something that's like from my soul, or even if it's just like a really raucous or joyful piece. If I'm not feeling raucous or joyful when I write it, the audience knows that. So the pieces have to be authentic to accomplish that. And so I'm never thinking while writing it, oh, they're going to clap really loud here, you know. But I can tell if I'm, it's going to, I can tell the audience is going to like it if when I'm listening to it and it's basically done and I can't sit still in my chair and I write with, like, you know, AirPods in, and, you know, my wife will text me from the next room and she'll be like, I guess you like your piece, because she can hear me moving around in my chair, or like my breath will go along with the piece and I'll like breathe really heavily, like, to certain things. And so if I get really excited like that viscerally, I think that there's a better chance the audience will also. Now, I get that wrong sometimes, but when I write something and I'm like, maybe it's fine, that's not the, like, those are the pieces where people just don't really respond. And I can't, and then if I deliver a piece like that, it means I just ran out of time, which I don't let happen very much anymore. I used to take too many commissions, but now I'm very careful about, like, giving myself a lot of time to figure it out and get it to the point where I'm like, that is as good as I can make that. Because when I was younger, I just took too much on, I think.
Well, when you're younger, you need to make sure that this is going to work as a job for you. So you kind of take stuff on.
For sure. And that's exactly what it was. Early on, you know, my first piece did really well and led to a lot of commissions all at the same time. And so I was like, well, I should take them all, even though it's going to be tough, because it would be amazing to just make a living as a composer, but also, like, maybe this is it. Maybe these are all the commissions I'm ever going to get. So I should take them all right now. And then if it goes away, at least I, you know, did those. But that was a mistake. So there are, you know, there's some early pieces where it just, like, you can tell where I was like, I spent a lot of time on this one, but then at the expense of the next one, possibly. And that happened even as recently as this piece that they're doing here, The Frozen Cathedral. I spent so much time on that piece, and I'm very proud of that piece. But then I had a piece I had to write right after it on a real crunch. It was a piece that was going to be delivered for someone's retirement. I didn't know when they were going to retire. And then they announced their retirement while I was finishing The Frozen Cathedral. So it was like, you need to have, this is going to premiere in May. Well, this was December, and I had to write a 20-minute piece now that I wasn't expecting to write immediately after, like, pouring everything out to write this Frozen Cathedral piece. So that piece has some, like, ups and downs in it, the piece right after that. So, you know, I really need time to recharge the tank, like, refill the tank and just, like, not think about music, you know, just do something else, or not think about my own music, at least.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I just, you know, the well runs dry, and I need time to refill that up again.
Do you make time for yourself to go to concerts of not your music?
Yes, for sure. And I don't go to a lot of classical concerts, actually. I see, like, you know, pop musicians that I like. And even, like, when I lived, so I just moved back to New York City. I'd been in San Francisco for a few years and had access to see the San Francisco Symphony. And I went several times, but I didn't go as often as I probably should have. Because, again, it's better, so much better live. Like, a live performance is a completely different experience than hearing a recording. And I, you know, when I was younger, I went to concerts all the time, especially like new music ensemble concerts and things that I would know going in, I'm probably not going to like a lot of this music, but it's still, as long as I'm not bored, it will have been a good experience to have gone to hear live music. And now that I'm back in New York, I'm hoping to do more of that. It's easier to go hear like new music ensemble things because those happen all the time. I've already been to one that was, I didn't like it at all, but I'm glad I went. It was very interesting. It was an hour and a half of a string quartet playing like as quietly as they could, just like quiet scratch tones for like an hour and a half. And I was like, I hate this so much, but it was interesting.
So, not to kind of go on a diversion here, but while you were listening to that and you're a composer, did you think to yourself, man, that's some guy had the nerve to write this down and,
yes,
and like expect the audience to kind of have the patience.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, it was interesting. I think I suggest this to young composers is go hear as much stuff as you possibly can, especially other new music, because the thing I got the most out of hearing new music ensemble concerts as a college student was I would be like, I hate this piece. What would I do differently to mm-hmm. make this piece so I didn't hate it? Like, is there an idea here? What is the idea that's good? Is there some way to rethink that idea in an approach that would make it so I would like this music? And so I tried doing that with an hour and a half of scratch tones. But this is a quartet that could play anything. This right. is a famous new music ensemble quartet. And so what made me mad about that is like, you had this incredible opportunity. They can play anything. And this is what you wanted them to do for 90 minutes. And it felt like the kind of music that would win a grant, but not music that an audience wants to hear. And it was packed because this quartet is a big deal. But it was, you're clapping for the ensemble when that thing ends. And so, yeah, pieces like that feel pretty self-indulgent, that's not my favorite
thing. And I sometimes think, you know, that somebody took somebody there on a date. Somebody who was not like dyed in the wool. Uh-huh. Like, I love this.
Yeah, I can't imagine what, if there was anyone there that was not used to going to new music ensemble concerts, which again, this was an extreme version of this.
Yeah.
This was a new music ensemble concert as part of a cutting edge new music ensemble festival.
Yeah.
And this was like the headliner group.
Yeah.
So, you know, going in, if you know that kind of stuff, this is going to be what my wife calls bleepy bloopy music.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't want to scare people away from new music ensemble concerts because a lot of them are astonishingly cool.
Right.
This was just a case where I was like, wow, I wouldn't have done this for 90 minutes. I kept thinking, they're going to change it, right? Like, they're going to, here comes the thing. And then eventually it just stopped. And they kind of like nodded and looked around and like, and people, there was like a slow start of clapping because they were like, I guess it's done. So, yeah, that's not my favorite.
Well, you've seen your work performed here in Gainesville before. My recollection from being at that performance was the audience received it very favorably, but you had, tell what was the work that was
performed? So that time, the last time I was here, and I think I've been here at least twice, maybe three times, but the last time I was here, I think was for a performance of a trombone concerto that I have called Harvest. And I had written it for Joe Alessi, who's the
from the New York Philharmonic.
Yeah, principal trombone of the New York Philharmonic. And he is considered by trombonists to be the greatest player who has ever played the trombone. And so it's kind of built in a little bit when you write a piece for someone that like that, that the crowd is going to, that person is going to be impressive.
Yes.
Which takes a little bit of the pressure off in writing the piece in a way.
And you probably felt like you could do anything with
it. Which is that's another challenge. And when I talked to him about what he wanted from a concerto, because he had a lot of concertos written for him, one of which that Christopher Rouse wrote for him won the Pulitzer Prize. Like, he's had some incredibly successful commissions. But what it sounded like from the ones that were not as successful as the Rouse was that people would know that he could do anything, and instead of writing him a piece, they would write him a demo. Like, this is what the trombone can do, yes. or this is what this person can do on the trombone. And so it was just trick after trick after trick, and there was no real music happening. And I had this meeting with him with my wife, Abby, and she said, I think he wants to sing through the trombone. I think he wants to be Pavarotti at the Met, you know, like, I think he wants like that kind of, like, give him a big aria kind of a thing. And so that was what I ended up doing, is try to like write him a story. It's a programmatic piece. And imagine him, actually imagine him as the Greek god Dionysus, like the god of wine, like the party god. And so like tell the story of that god with him as that role, but with no text or anything. And that was a fun way to approach it and allowed me to write something that anything I could think of, I knew he could do, but I wasn't going into it thinking I'm going to show everything he can do. It happened organically that it's a very difficult piece, but not because I was trying to write a difficult piece, just because I wasn't trying to, you know, I wasn't thinking, well, there was never any concern about anything I would think of not being playable perfectly by him, because if it's possible, he could do it and make it sound easy. But that, yeah, that piece, that's a fun one, especially when he plays it. But a lot of people have played it, and it's sometimes it's a little bit scarier when some other people do it.
So finally, you know, your piece that's being performed this week, when you're there, what will you be listening for most closely?
Oh, that's interesting. So I have rehearsal this afternoon. I haven't heard the group yet. With this one, this piece is all about shape and pacing, because it has to tell this, you know, sort of heavy story. The first third is very, you know, dark, and the second one is bright and has a slow build. And so I need to, it's really just to make sure that they're pacing it okay. Because if the pacing is done effectively, then the audience is taken on this journey where they reach this, like, you know, release of, you know, healing or something like that by the end. And then people are happy. So, you know, this is an exceptional group here. So I'm not, and you know, Dave Wainwright is a wonderful musician. So I think this is just going to be a fun one. Like, this is not one where like, you know, like, sometimes, you know, it's a piece that has so much percussion, and it has 10 percussion players, and you know, they're all over the audience and everything, and it's just like, there's a lot of spectacle that goes into it, and if that's all done, you know, with respect and you know, done effectively, then I think the piece comes off well. And the hardest thing about this piece is really the chops for the players, is like, because it has this long, slow chorale in the brass, while there's fast music happening around it, but the brass has to play like basically long tones for 8 minutes. And you need like mature players to do that and like shape that in a way that's not too loud at the beginning, or they're not just overblowing by the end. And this is a mature group that that's going to be, that problem I don't have to worry about here. So I think it's going to be amazing. I'm really excited.
Well, I'm excited for the local audience to get to hear this work. And I'm really grateful to you for coming in. Thank you for spending some time with me.
Thank you. It was nice chatting with you. Thanks a lot.